Yeah, I requested about 10 years ago to be able to lay on the floor when I'm not in the game, and you need like a medical pass. And so, you know, I've had back issues dating back to 2006, and sort of the maintenance of that is when I'm off the court, I foam roll, I lay down on my back, and I do Pilates exercises. Unfortunately for me, last night in the game against the Clippers, the camera caught me in this position, and I became a meme.
That's the Pelicans' J.J. Redick on how his 1,000-yard stare became the face of the NBA restart on Saturday as his team fell to the Clippers. I was going to ask you about that. What's it like to now be in the Hall of Memes?
You have to understand, last night I was so angry. I don't know why. I was angry we got our butts kicked. It's embarrassing, you know, and I think my face summed up that first half pretty well.
I mean, it's going to be embarrassing for whoever has the meme attached to them when it's like that face when your girlfriend dumps you and you didn't realize it. And it's just like a zoom in on you, stone face, just staring into the middle distance.
there's so many circumstances that you could apply the emotions that I was going through in that moment.
While so much of sports is in chaos, whether it's the coronavirus outbreaks or players opting out or continued negotiations over how, when, and whether to play, the NBA finally has its first bubble games under its belt. Today, a view inside the league. J.J. Redick joins the show to talk about the sights and sounds of a 2020 season where there is plenty of action off the court. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, August 3rd. This is ESPN Daily. I want to know, first off, where are you right now, man?
I'm just in my hotel room in the NBA bubble. We're staying at a wonderful resort called the Yacht Club, which by most accounts is the third best hotel in the bubble.
J.J. Redick plays for the New Orleans Pelicans and hosts the J.J. Redick podcast with Tommy Alter.
They based it on record. So I hadn't actually left my hotel. I've only gone to the gym and back. And then last night after the game, I went over to see some of the Pacers guys at the Grand Floridian. And I can now unequivocally say that we do not have the best hotel.
Wait, hold on. So how does the other half live in the Grand Floridian? What do they have that you guys don't have?
I mean, basically, their lake is a lot bigger.
What an NBA player sentence. Their lake is bigger than our lake.
They have a wonderful view directly to the castle in Magic Kingdom. And I've got to be honest, our hotel serves amazing food at the restaurant. The staff there is wonderful. You know, we've all sort of gotten to know each other. It's the same people every day. However, at the Grand Floridian, their restaurant has lake views. It's like a waterfront setup. And I noticed last night, the chef came over to the table and she's like, "What do you guys want to make for you tonight?" So it's almost like a bespoke experience. I was blown away.
Well, let's get to the actual basketball, because you've now played two real live games in the bubble. And one of them was the bubble opener, which I think history will regard it as, against the Jazz. And then Saturday against the Clippers, which did not go in your favor. That was a tough game. But give me the sense of what it's like to actually be playing in games that matter under these circumstances.
The actual gameplay feels very normal. It feels competitive. The game the other night with Utah felt like a normal NBA game. Getting beat by 35 or whatever we ended up losing to against the Clippers did not feel normal. That was like a nightmare. Not playing in front of fans is such a unique experience. From the original scrimmage where they didn't pump any crowd noise in, And it just felt like you were playing in an empty gym. You know, you get to the, you go to the free throw line and it's crickets. It's literally silence in the gym. To yesterday and you know, in previous games where they've got the virtual fans in the background and they're pumping in crowd noise and there's music, it feels a little more normal. But the whole experience outside of when you're in the game, the whole experience is pretty surreal.
Yeah. I mean, at home, it weirdly feels normal and familiar. But for you, I mean, when you talk about being surreal, like, I'd heard that you had complaints about lights when this was all starting. Give me some sense of like actually being on stage.
It does feel a little bit like being on a Broadway stage. At one of the gyms where we played our scrimmages, the locker room is like a makeshift locker room. They walled off a section of the concourse where there's a bathroom, and you walk down a ramp and you walk through a curtain. And you're just on a court with these bright lights that have been set up basically on scaffolding. It really feels like you're on stage. The arena where we played our two games feels a little more open. It feels a little bit more like you're playing on a, you know, in a basketball arena. And the lights in that court, I will say, have been dimmed quite a bit.
And is that the JJ Redick rule? Is that what we're calling it? Were there complaints that you made formally?
I'm not going to say it has anything to do with me. I do know that there were multiple players from multiple teams that requested the lights to go down just a tad. I was not the only one who had an issue with the lights.
Breaking news, JJ Redick, responsible for the dimming of the lights. But hold on, because you were the home team in one of these games and the away team in another one of these games. Was there a difference?
Pablo, I can't figure it out. I'm not even sure our team realizes, like, if we are home or away until we see, like, which logos are on the virtual fans.
And so there's no advantage, in other words. There's no home court advantage.
I don't really think there is. I should mention this too. The other really enjoyable thing, I think, has been the bench experience. We're all socially distanced on the bench. We have our own chairs. They feel almost like a video game chair.
Yeah, gamer chairs. I've noticed that.
Yes.
Very spaced out gamer chairs.
Yes, and we have a little cubby with our drinks and our snacks. And I'm like, it just, why can't we do this for all NBA games? I know it would eat into some of the crowd space, obviously, but we're all rather large humans and you're just crammed next to each other. I like this setup a lot better.
Well, in terms of the restart, you know, there is a prevailing theory that the league basically gerrymandered the playoff districts somewhat to make sure that the Pelicans, but particularly your teammate Zion Williamson, would be in the bubble. What does that theory sound like to you?
I wouldn't disagree with that. I think that's pretty accurate. You know, I would also say Damian Lillard is a superstar and he's here. I think Devin Booker is on his way to being a superstar. Bradley Beal is on his way to being a superstar. Look, I'm keenly aware that superstars drive our league and drive interest in our league. And Zion is the up and coming superstar. And for me, I'm just fortunate that I'm on his team and I got to be here.
So right now, the Pelicans are going through this whole management program with Zion, where he played 15 minutes in game one, 14 minutes in game two. How do you feel about that? Because, for instance, as a fan, it was kind of strange and frustrating to watch Zion be incredible for 15 minutes in game one, but then not be there when the game was actually on the line.
Obviously, as his teammate, you want him out there in those moments, but you also have to understand that every player in our program, and not just Zion, has followed a protocol to return to 5-on-5 action. And so for many of us, we got three scrimmages. We got about 15 live practices. Zion got like three, and then he left and was gone for nearly 2 weeks to deal with a family issue. And so I think it's unfair to just insert him back after nearly 5 months off without playing 5-on-5. That's a difficult thing to do for anyone, especially someone who, you know, had a very serious injury back in October of last year and didn't play till January. So I think the Pelicans are doing the smart thing and they're doing the right thing. I understand from a fan perspective how frustrating that can be, but taking the long-term view and the long-term approach is the right thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you think about Zion, he is what? Is he 20 years old? Is that how old he is now?
He just turned 20, yes.
So, I mean, he just turns 20. I mean, when you were 20, you were at Duke being awesome at college basketball?
I think I was junior year, I was 20 years old, yep.
As fame is concerned, I mean, you were also somebody who was in the middle of the spotlight at the top of your game. And to the point where, like, dude, I remember there was a Sports Illustrated story. You had poetry in there. It seemed very earnest. And then blogs are making fun of you, ripping it apart. First off, do you remember that?
It's funny. Bomani Jones and I, we were actually talking about the poetry. He reminded me of this article that he wrote back in 2006 for Page Two. Bomani's not a Duke guy.
He is not.
And he basically was like, yeah, just like lay off JJ. JJ's a good player. I don't understand the hate. He did say something about the awful poetry. And he goes, I've always wondered this 14 years later. Were those just rap lyrics? And I was like, yeah, they were rap lyrics. No one picked up on that. They were just, it wasn't poetry. They were rap lyrics. I had a buddy who played soccer at Duke. We had this terrible makeshift setup in his dorm room. And he would make beats, or we would take instrumentals off Kazam, and we would make rap songs. We would have like hooks and stuff. I mean, it was great. It was great. I don't know where those songs are. They exist somewhere on a hard drive.
I feel like, I mean, your podcast must find the lost JJ tapes. I mean, just because we're on the subject, if I give you one line from a poem, do you think you'll be able to tell me the next one?
It's possible. It's possible.
All right. These words describe the soundtrack to my life's song.
No, I don't remember that.
My mind and body united like the colors of Benetton was what we were looking for, JJ, which I particularly loved.
That was kind of a fire bar. I mean, a fire little... That was... Come on.
Let's do one more because I want to see if you can remember this. Hold on.
There's something in there about a hurricane. I do remember.
Okay. Hold on. Let me find. Yeah. Okay, here we go. A tornado tears me down, but I will stand again.
Oh, man.
My life is a hurricane, but I'll weather it to the end.
Ooh. No one's ever read back my rap lyrics to me before. And this is such a... This is such a proud moment for me. Thank you, Pablo.
Coming up, let's talk about some other things that are different in the bubble, including your training routine and also preparing for the social and political side of a completely unique season.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
JJ, you're known for a workout and practice regimen that is impressive and relentless and, I don't know, just a lot more intense than, say, anything a journalist like myself might imagine for exercise. But even for the NBA, I mean, coach and analyst Stan Van Gundy said that you're the single best conditioned athlete in the league. So how are you keeping that up in the bubble? And also, do you accept that title?
I will accept the title of one of the best conditioned athletes. I think it's the base of my success as a basketball player is just being in better shape than most people, being able to run, having endurance. You know, the shots that I take on the move requires a good deal of stamina. And that started the summer between my sophomore and junior year at Duke. That's when I really just, my lifestyle completely changed. And the basis of my lifestyle is just being in great shape. I don't get out of shape in the off season. During the quarantine, I had access to a gym and I played this year. I don't know if it was the New Orleans food, but I played this year at like 205, 206. And I was like, I don't like this weight. Nothing had changed my lifestyle. I guess maybe it was just part of it was getting older. So during the quarantine, those, you know, 3 months before I went down to New Orleans, I worked out 6 days a week and I really just sprinted. Like I was making up these conditioning drills on the fly. I'm in the mid 190s now, so I lost a little over 10 pounds. Actually, Rodney Magruder last night in the Clippers after the game was like, yo, you look so skinny, man. And I was like, you couldn't give me a better compliment like that. Thank you. And really, it's just like making sure you get your shots up, doing your routine there, lifting basically 3 days a week, but doing body work pretty much every day. I believe in taking an off day every week. Your body needs it. But other than that, you're constantly, you know, working on your body. You're constantly working on your game. And the league has done a great job of providing a space in every venue that we have. We have a weight room essentially in one of the hotel rooms. We have weight rooms at every practice court, and we have access to extra shooting. So it's been really no different in the bubble in terms of the sharpening and refining of skills.
So is there a subculture in the league around like those who are workout obsessives? Do you guys all keep in touch? Do you know who each other are?
A little bit, yeah. So much of what I did initially was about survival. Mm. It was about trying to break into Stan Van Gundy's rotation. How do I do that? What do I need to do? Okay, I got to get stronger. I need to focus more on lifting weights. I got to go do that. As I got older and now all of a sudden you have this reputation, you now have guys start reaching out to you. Hey, what do you do? What does your off-season training look like? And then you learn that one of your favorite players growing up, someone like Ray Allen, is as obsessed, if not probably him, probably more obsessed than me. But this is just who I am right now. It's until I'm done playing, like this is just who I am. It's just part of my life.
So I'm curious, when you were watching, I presume you watched The Last Dance, of course.
Yes.
So you're watching The Last Dance. Michael Jordan in that is preaching to the cult of competitiveness and hard work and obsessiveness. What was your reaction watching him articulate his viewpoint on that stuff as, you know, many people's goat?
I totally understood so much of what he said during that documentary. In fact, I actually had an issue with some of the backlash that he got. But Michael, I mean, he was ruthless. I played with Chris Paul. Chris Paul is ruthless. And I appreciated Chris Paul. I loved playing with Chris. Some guys can handle that. Some guys can't. I loved it.
Do you think you're as competitive as Michael Jordan? Do you think that it's possible that other people could be as competitive as the man we all think is the supreme leader in that regard?
It's a great question. Stan Van Gundy, whose takes I just always appreciate. And during that documentary, I think he came out in an interview and he said, JJ Redick and Udonis Haslam are the most competitive players that I've coached, and they were as competitive as Michael Jordan. Mm. The difference is Michael Jordan was way more talented. you know, way, way more, like different tiers by several miles. That's why he is Maybe he's the GOAT. I don't know. It's up for debate. But
Have a take, Reddick. Come on. You're in the media now. Have a take.
So much of your viewpoint is shaped by your peers. And I've said for a long time, I think LeBron is the greatest player of all time. Mm. When I watched The Last Dance, and I actually, prior to watching The Last Dance, I had been on this like 3 to 6 month binge on YouTube where I was rewatching highlights from all of Jordan's greatest games. To me, it's almost like you have the sort of 80s. You know, the Magic and Larry get drafted up until when Jordan retires. That's an era. The Kobe Shaq up until now, that's an era. The pre-modern NBA is, you know, pre-ABA merger, pre-Magic and Larry, that's an era. And it's difficult to compare greatness between those eras because the game was different and the league was different.
Yeah, and honestly, like a lot of this debate, if we're being truly candid with ourselves, it always kind of feels like my dad can beat up your dad. It's like childhood. It's like, how do I remember my childhood? And how yes. dare you denigrate said childhood? Coming up, more with JJ about playing the 2020 season against this backdrop of more athletes than ever before who are speaking out on racial injustice.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
JJ, the era we live in right now might be defined by what's happening outside of the game, maybe even more so than what's happening inside of it. So the other thing you've spent so much time preparing for, along with your teammates, is how to keep up momentum and attention on issues of racial injustice as you return to play actual basketball. And so when the NBA restarted in that bubble opener, there you were, kneeling with your teammates and your opponents during the national anthem.
The two teams had talked about what to do. And I know Chris Paul had some input there as well about just the positioning. You know, it was I think it was important just from a viewing perspective that when we were kneeling, that the flag, which represents something different to so many people, but the flag was, you know, on this giant screen behind us. The flag is important. We're not saying the flag is not important, and it represents different things to different people. The flag is important. We're playing the national anthem. It was a remix done by John Batiste. Like, that is powerful in itself. The Black Lives Matter on the court is visible. We're kneeling next to that. I was emotional that first game against Utah while we were making that statement. It was powerful. You know, to all the people who want to just denigrate what we're trying to do and want to knock, you know, wearing t-shirts or putting Black Lives Matter on the court or speaking about these things during media availability, I would just say this. We're already doing things. We're already taking action. If you look across the league, there's going to be a fund, and I think it's upwards of $300 million. There's going to be a fund with the union in conjunction with owners that are going to invest directly in Black communities and invest directly in some of these organizations, these grassroots organizations that are making change across our country. We had athletes travel 15 hours to drive down to their hometown and lead peaceful protests in Atlanta. I'm speaking about Jaylen Brown.
Yeah, yeah.
Malcolm Brogdon and Jaylen Brown. Like, we are doing things, some publicly, some privately, but we're all doing things. We're all trying to affect change in this country. That moment during the national anthem, I felt so proud to be in our league, to be surrounded by my peers, to be surrounded by my teammates, people that I love, and be in that moment. And I would also say I was proud to be an American in that moment, that I had the ability to peacefully protest. Being able to do that is honoring our country. That is patriotic. No one in our league has said they don't respect the military. We all, Myers Leonard, what he did yesterday, we respect that. Your brother's an active service member. The flag means something to you. He's having those conversations with his teammates so that they understand his viewpoint, and how we're acting is American. I believe that.
You chose "Say Their Names" as the slogan on the back of your jersey, replacing your last name. What was that discussion and planning process like for you in terms of choosing what you wanted to use?
So I lived with Drew Holiday when I went back to New Orleans. You know, each team had to return to their home market. So Drew and I basically lived together for almost 2 weeks prior to coming down to Orlando. And the days pretty much looked like we'd go to the gym, he would take a nap, I would go to the pool, and then we would have dinner together. And we had some amazing conversations over dinner. And prior to the league, you know, providing us with whatever it was, 25 or 30 options to put on the back of our jerseys, I had talked a little bit about some of the ideas that I had for what I wanted to put on my jersey. So one idea was Ruby Bridges, who was the first Black child to integrate New Orleans public schools. And there's a famous Norman Rockwell painting from 1964 where she's walking between state troopers with, you know, the N-word in the background. She's still alive. She's still very much an activist. Those options weren't available to me. So I looked at the options, and what hit home to me was "Say Their Names." And I had been to two protests in Brooklyn in the week after George Floyd was murdered. And one of the things that was impressed upon me was the value of individual lives, the value of each person, the value of each Black American that has been brutalized by police in this country. And you can go down the list and you can name all their names, but each person was somebody's son or daughter or girlfriend or sister. Their lives mattered. That's why I chose "Say Their Names."
When did activism of this kind become a thing for you as an athlete? When did it become a focus?
As I built out the podcast starting 4 years ago, you know, I found my voice a little bit, and I can actually remember the episode because I got an email from the guy who, you know, who basically hired me to do the podcast. This guy, Chris, he emailed me and he's like, "You found your voice. That episode, you found your voice." And the episode was post 2016 free agency madness. I had Woj on the pod, and I said something which I also repeated recently, and it blew up on social media, and I got a ton of backlash for. All I said was, Kevin Durant, part of this backlash, of course, is the fact that he's joining the team that just beat him. He's joining a super team. Of course, some of the backlash is that. But in the same way that there was backlash for LeBron in 2010, some of this backlash is that people are uncomfortable with powerful Black men making decisions, especially powerful Black athletes. But the real turning point for me was living through the Donald Sterling situation, because I couldn't, at that point, I was like, I can't ignore this. I can't be blind to this anymore. You know, you're in that meeting with Doc when this tape comes out and your teammates are in tears and you see how personal it is. My understanding of the existence of white privilege, it's intuitive for most of my life. It's intuitive. I knew it was there. I didn't know it had a name. For a lot of people, the lexicon of white privilege, like, this is a new thing for people in the last few years. Like, oh, this is called something. And maybe I was ignorant to not understand that it was called something, but I always knew it existed. And you have to grapple with that.
Now you're expanding your ambitions as a podcaster, right? I mean, this is something that you are taking super seriously. What can you tell us about where you go from here, given all that you just described?
We are actually launching a new podcast beginning in January. I've had a co-host for the last basically 8 months, Tommy Alter, who you know, of course. He's a friend of yours as well. Tommy kind of knows everybody. We wanted to own a podcast and we wanted to start a podcast company. And so this week we are launching a brand new podcast. It's called The Old Man and the Three. It's a little play, it's a little play on Hemingway. I, of course, in this scenario, am the old man. It's also a little self-deprecating because I am the old guy in the locker room. So, you know, the goal over the next couple years will be to build out a podcast network.
Yeah, no, that sounds like a real serious endeavor. And I look forward to listening, man. All I will leave you with are the wise words of a wise man. I can't see what my future has in store, but I move forth with the strength
of a condor.
There it is. JJ Redick. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you, Papa.
That was JJ Redick of the New Orleans Pelicans. They face the Memphis Grizzlies tonight, live from Orlando on ESPN. And while the NBA moves ahead, we have a week full of uncertainty in other sports. There's the chaos that's descended upon MLB with the Cardinals battling a coronavirus outbreak. In the NFL, we have the unbubbled camps starting up and player opt-out deadlines looming. And in college football, there are hundreds of Pac-12 players vowing to sit out unless demands about health and racial justice and fair pay are met. We'll be going in depth on all that and more right here on ESPN Daily. I'm Pablo Torre. I'll talk to you tomorrow.